Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:38 p.m. on Monday, January 31st, 2022. Present today, we've got Representative Thompson, Representative Edgman, Representative Johnson, myself, Co-Chair Foster. Also, we should have some folks online. We do have Representative Rasmussen. Are you there?
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, I'm here.
Okay. And then Representative Merrick is, I think she should be on at some point here.
Yep, thank you.
Oh, Representative Merrick, I see you online there. Thank you very much. And okay, so just a reminder, if folks could please mute their cell phones. And this afternoon, we'll be hearing a presentation from the Department of Revenue about the state savings accounts, budget reserves, and investment funds. Here to present, we have Brian Fechter, the Deputy Commissioner, as well as Pam Leary, Chief Investment Officer. So if both of you could please come up to the table and put yourselves on the record and go ahead and proceed with your testimony. Thanks for joining us today. And also, just for the record, we've got Representative Ortiz is also here.
Okay, for the record, I am Brian Fechter. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us here to testify on investment funds and cash flows. Here with me is our Director of the Treasury Division, Pam Leary, and I'll let her put herself onto the record as well and introduce herself.
Thank you, Chair Fosta and members of the committee. My name is Pam Leary, for the record. I am the Director of the Treasury Division. And today we're going to provide you an update on some of the state investment funds as well as a discussion of cash flows and revenue volatility management.
Okay, and if I could, I'd just like to note that we've also got Representative Wool with us as well. Please continue.
So going to slide three, our update on the state investment funds will start looking at a handful of funds that are the state funds and then the pension funds in terms of their historical asset balances, as well as some key investment statistics. And these are all managed at the Treasury. Thank you. On slide four, we have the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. This is a depiction of the historical assets since the beginning of their creation in 1990. It is in the blue area. That is what we refer to as the main fund. In the yellow area, it's what we refer to as the sub-fund of the CBRF. And that was created in the year 2000, but really funded substantially in the year 2008 with a $4.1 billion deposit. The CBRF has been used to fund temporary cash flow expenses as well as budget revenue shortfalls. And the last borrowing for that purpose was in fiscal year 2021 of $960 million. A key note of the CBRF is that appropriations from the fund must be repaid. And as of the fiscal year 20 ending financial statements, it was owed $12.8 billion. There is no time period for the repayment, and there is no interest that accrues to the fund. On slide five, we've presented some of the investment key statistics. You can see that right now, the CBRF is funded to 100% cash equivalents for its target asset allocation, and that's like money markets and treasury bills, et cetera. It is a very short investment horizon fund, meaning that we anticipate that funds could be used within a very short time period. The market value as of 12/31/2021 was nearly $1.1 billion, and you can see the history for the last 5 years of the market value of the fund. Currently, as of the end of December, the rolling one-year returns as of for the 1 year is 0.09%, and the short-term projected return for the year is 0.05%. There aren't any other questions on CBR. I will move to
Representative Edgman.
So the question that you're asked ever so frequently, and you talk about a fair amount at this table, and there's never really a good answer for it other than just sort of conjecture or a reply that just maybe fits the particular circumstances at hand. But the CBR, as I understand it, is the state's checking account in terms of cash flow, cash inflow and outflow. Every month, the money comes in and out of the CBR to deal with the needs around the state, right? I mean, that's what it's used for.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, that is not, in fact, what the CBR is. That's the general fund proper. The CBR is our savings fund, but money has come from that fund to the general fund in past years, the last 5 years or so, to then provide funds to make the state's payments. So it's the savings fund or the rainy day fund, some people call it.
Mr. Mm-hmm. But I do believe in the past it has been used as a source of money to run to basically fund the state's needs, as whether or not it's money coming from the permit fund on a quarterly basis or oil revenue not arriving or whatever the needs might be, the CBR has been used as for cash flow purposes, at least in the past, because I've sat here at the table. We've had those discussions. Maybe it's not every single month. But the question that no one can answer is what should be, how much money we should actually have in the CBR to be able to provide that amount of certainty in case there is a drop in oil prices or something happens along the way where we need to have, be able to reserve money, because it takes the legislature 3/4 vote to appropriate money out of the CBR, but in terms of using money in the short term on a month-to-month basis, you don't need the legislature's authority to do that. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but the question that you hear all the time is, well, how much should be in the CBR? And is $800 million, mm-hmm. if we lose the higher ed fund, is that appropriate? And is that sort of a safeguard amount that we want to keep in there, or do we want to have more? In case oil prices do plummet. The question I'm trying to get at, Mr. Co-Chair, is $800 million, let's just pick that number, worst case scenario, is that an appropriate amount to have in CBR?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the sort of walking around number that the Department of Revenue has been using is about $1 billion for cash flow. We view it as sort of being able to weather 2 years of oil price volatility, and we'll get into a little more depth later on in this presentation some of the other mechanisms we have at our fingertips, such as revenue anticipation borrowing and other mechanisms that can assist us if we get into a situation where it's not possible to have that $1 billion minimum balance in the fund.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for my own clarification, the just over $1 billion, which was the balance on 12/30/21, did that reflect the deposit made by the money that was gained by the sweep? In other words, does that reflect the sweep of balance as well?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it does not. It's purely the cash balances. And the June 30 sweepable fund transfer has not yet been done on a cash basis. We are awaiting guidance from the annual financial report of the state, which I think is coming out next month, to help identify where funds should be moving and what amounts those funds should be moving to and from.
Thank you.
Please continue.
On slide six is the power cost equalization historical invested assets. This was funded initially in the year 2000, and then again in 2007 and 2012. The purpose of the fund is to provide stable financing for areas that have high cost service normally of the state. The target allocation for this fund we'll get into, but part of the history of the fund is it moved from 7% to 5%. And that coincided with the change to a 5% POMV, or percent of market value, appropriation for the fund. And of that amount, 70%, if it exceeds the amount from the prior year, 70% can be spent on related identified programs, included community assistance programs, as well as renewable energy grants and bulk fuel revolving loan funds. And that amount cannot exceed $55 million each year. At the end of June 30, the amount was $1.15 billion. In terms of the investment statistics, this is a intermediate investment horizon, so it's a longer term fund. It is targeted with a higher risk return. You can see that the asset allocation has many more colors of blue, shades of blue in it, which roughly equate to about a 56% equity to 44% bond asset allocation. The market value as of the end of December was a little bit higher of $1.1 billion. And the one-year return as of the end of December was 7.12%, and the projected 10-year return is 5%. Moving on to slide eight, we have the Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund. This fund was created in 2012 with a capitalization of $400 million. It is to be swept as of the end of June 30th. So this is one of the funds we're awaiting guidance on. The fund is still invested as it was previously. And once we get the guidance, we'll determine how the funds can move over to the CBR. Slide nine shows the statistics. Again, this is a high risk return invested fund, a long investment horizon still, even though we know that there are going to be changes to the fund. And the balance as of the end of December was $422 million. At the end of December, the 1 year return was 12.55%, and the projected 10-year return is 5.62%.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What's the withdrawal rate on the higher education investment fund? Is it 5%, 3-year average? I mean, do you have a set formula? And I noticed it was capitalized at $400 million in 2012, and it's still 422, so it's gained some value, but how much of the earnings do you take every year?
I believe that the appropriation amount is up to 7% annually, that's the amount that's allowed, but my recollection is that is it in the $30 to $40 million range annually?
For the record, Brian Fector, Deputy Commissioner, through the chair, Representative Wool, it floats around a little bit, but it does tend to be in the $30 to $40 million a year range, and not every year does the legislature choose to do the full 7%, so it really does vary year to year.
Thank you. Is it based on need of the number of students? Because if your projected 10-year return is 5.62 and you're taking 7, obviously, I mean, does it depend on how many students are apply and
qualify?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm just curious, you know, up to 7 or around 7, I mean, that those are all good numbers, and I certainly want funds to go out. I'm not trying to.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, over the years we have had a number of discussions as to the sustainability long term of the withdrawal rate. You did hit the nail on the head in that we only spend the money if there's enough, let's say, seats in WAMI and students who qualify for the scholarship. So anything unspent at the end of the year will lapse back into that fund, and it's something that both OMB and Legislative Finance are monitoring on an ongoing basis to make sure that it's not being drawn so far beyond what it's capable of earning in the long term to harm the real value of that endowment.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you touched on the answer that I was going to ask. The question I was going to ask was the WAMI program. I see we're adding 10 additional students this year into the WAMI program. Is that going to have a much of an effect on where we're doing this as far as the draw that we're doing?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, the way the governor has set up his budget this year is that because many of these sweepable funds have swept, he replaced those spending items with the unrestricted general fund. And so it won't be an additional draw from the higher education fund because, in theory, that has already swept. And so we view this as a positive thing for some of the students because there's a bit of a cost benefit between general fund and higher education fund funding of these programs. On the one hand, because this fund is DGF, it doesn't receive the level of scrutiny that an unrestricted general fund appropriation would. But on the other hand, funding it through DGF makes it susceptible to that three-quarter vote reverse sweep. And so because it's funded through the unrestricted general fund, it, in our view, gives a little bit of certainty to the students who rely on these scholarships.
Follow up? Thank you. Since there is a pending lawsuit and we're in the middle of the budget process, should that lawsuit reverse the sweep of these funds back to the higher education fund, do we need to put language in our budget that states that if that lawsuit happens, that we would reverse where the funding source comes from?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, that is purely a sort of budget structure / mechanical question, and it is at the will of the legislature to either do that or keep it as the governor has proposed it. It's purely up to the respective bodies of the legislature.
Thank you.
Representative Edgman and then Ortiz.
Yeah, and I think that's an excellent point, Representative Thompson, that you bring up just as a contingency measure because we don't know the outcome of that court case. And speaking of the court case, if the courts determine that the money, that the higher ed fund is in fact swept, it's in the CBR forever, right? Basically speaking.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, that's correct.
And if I might, the program was started in 2013, but I think the higher ed fund was not considered sweepable for the first, what, 6, 7, 8 years of its existence. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I'd have to go back and look. There have been a number of iterations across multiple administrations as to what the legal analysis of the moment believes is and is not sweepable.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, I believe I am correct. The administration or the Walker administration, and I don't know if that was like last year or the year before, what was deemed sweepable. And the reason I bring that up is because there's a certain arbitrary nature to what is sweepable and what may not be sweepable. I'm not trying to make an indictment here or anything like that, but it's just that, you know, if in fact the courts say, look, this is part of the CBR, it's swept, that means the legislature has to come up with that money every year separately. That's adding to the budget. That's 20 some odd million or whatever it is to the budget every year, because that's our only recourse, right, is to pay it out of UGF. Am I missing something there?
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, that's largely correct. In the absence of having this endowment to fund those programs, another funding source would need to be identified, and in this case, the governor selected unrestricted general funds.
And then I guess, Mr. Kutcher, the last point I would make is that it's, you know, we in effect, if that were to be the case, would be switching that $400 million pot of money from an expected return rate of 5.6% to an expected return rate of 0.05, 0.5%, if it, in fact, remains in the CBR going forward, of course, the term has been swept, and that's a bit unfortunate. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Ortiz.
Just very quickly, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to Representative Wool's question around the amount of money that's withdrawn from the account yearly, he spoke about it in terms of percentages. Within the framework that you talked about, you said that the amount of people who qualify for, like, the scholarship fund or for the WAMI program have an impact on that. But the way it's structured does can, let's say, can you make the determination on the basis of what's best for the health of the overall fund that even though there's maybe a higher than expected amount of people who qualify, can you still cut that off at a certain amount so that you don't overdraw, or is it purely totally dictated by how many people qualify each year and you just meet those obligations because you're bound to by law or the desire to meet the scholarships, the kids who qualify?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, largely, yes. I believe it's a flat dollar amount that gets put into the budget, and annually the Department of Education, in tandem with the Post-Secondary Education Commission, come up with a estimate as to how much spend down would be required to fully fulfill those earned scholarships and those earned slots at the WAMI medical education. And so to the extent that student numbers come in low, that money would remain in the fund for future use. To the extent that they come in high, I think they build a little bit of a buffer into their numbers so that we don't get into a situation where we have more obligations than we do budgetary authority, and if they do, the supplemental process is, of course, at their fingertips.
Thank you.
Representative Wool?
Might as well keep on this vein. $400 million, 7%, $28 million, just rough. We're talking about WAMI students of 10 or 20 or something like that. So that's a small piece of the draw. I would think the majority of it is undergraduate students at UAF, all the high school students coming in, right? I mean, that's got to be the lion's share of these funds. That's right?
Through the chair, Representative Wool. Yes, the lion's share of the funds is accruing to those performance scholarship recipients and largely the University of Alaska prospective students. Over the years, there have been some what I might describe as off-use, off-designation appropriations from the fund. One year, the funding for PERS pension obligations came from this fund. Periodically over the years, some sort of related programs like Online with Library and Online Homework Help have been appropriated from this fund. And so it just sort of depends on the year and sort of how the budget process progresses.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. That's good to know. I wasn't aware of that, and again, I haven't this committee that long, so I don't, I wasn't aware of those anomalies, I guess I would call them, but, and maybe that's perfectly within the defined use of the fund. So there's a line item budget, line item in this year's budget, which is basically funding all the scholarships without the withdrawal from the fund, because if the fund is swept, there is no earnings from the fund that we have access to for the scholarships. So is that the amount that's in the budget now is simply for the performance scholarships and WAMI? And I don't know that number off the top of my head. I'm assuming it's, do you know that number off the top of your head? I guess that's my question.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, not off the top of my head, but we can respond back. It is in the normal sort of brackets. I know they added a few seats this year to the WAMI rolls, so it'll be an uptick from the prior year.
Okay, thank you. And last follow up, these things like PERS, TERS that were paid for out of this fund, is that an anomaly, an exception, or does that happen with frequency that there's other things that get paid out of the higher education fund?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that did happen under the previous administration, and I would very much describe that as an anomaly. For the most part, the legislature does tend to stick with the designations that they write in statute. It's just every so often for sort of ease of budgeting, we see these little anomalous events and have to sort of note them in the record.
Well, last comment. I can understand how online libraries could be attached to education. PERS, TERS, I think it's a little more of a leap as far as intent, but I'll look into that further. Thank you.
Representative Bridgman.
So just a quick hypothetical. The state is looking at having some surplus money this year, which is great news. But if we were to take some of that surplus funds and put it into this investment fund, would it take statutory change to do that? I'm guessing it probably wouldn't. But if we were to expand the purpose of the higher education investment fund to allow it to do more things than what it's to do at this point, that would probably take statutory language. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Edgemond. Yes, that's correct. To change the designation of this fund, that would take a statutory change in order to do that. But of course, the legislature is permitted to spend funds outside of the designation because we do have a anti-dedicated funds clause within our state constitution.
And of course, through the chair, we would not be prohibited from capitalizing on money in the fund either.
Through the chair, Representative Edgemond, that is correct. If the legislature chose to recapitalize this fund, that would be a completely legal and allowable thing to do.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
Moving to slide 10. This is a chart of the historical invested assets of the general fund and other non-segregated investments. We refer to it with an acronym, JFONSI. JFONSI has two components, one and two. JFONSI 2 was created in 2018 to target a slightly higher risk return profile for a certain set of funds. There are about 180 funds that are managed together in these two separate JFONSIs, but they are accounted for separately. At the end of this last fiscal year, June 30, 2021, there was about $3.5 billion in the JFONSI total, and one of the funds in the JFONSI is the general fund proper, and that was about $1.6 billion at the end of June, but by July it was down to $600 million, and that's because that is our operating account or working capital account that money comes in and out of on its way to wherever it's going, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later in the cash flow section. Slide 11 shows the investment statistics for both JFONSI 1 and JFONSI 2. You can see that JFONSI 2 has a 6% allocation to equity, has a little bit more of the risky fixed income for slated for a slightly higher return. The combined total at the end of December of the Jafonzies was $2.8 billion. And you can see that the 1231 returns for the year is negative 0.35% for Jafonzi 1 and 0.85% for Jafonzi 2. Also, you can see the short-term return projections. Again, these are short-term, 0.27% for Jafonzi 1 and 0.91% for Jafonzi 2.
Representative Edgman?
Yeah, somebody was asking me over the weekend about community assistance funds and where they might actually reside. The fund itself, not the money that comes from the PCE, should there be a surplus in the PC endowment earnings. But is this where the community assistance funds reside?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, yes. Moving on to slide 12, we have the Public School Trust Fund. This fund is funded by 0.5% of state receipts from the management of state lands, mineral leases, rentals, and royalties. It was established quite some time ago in 1978. It was formerly managed as two funds together, a principal and an interest fund. And it's now managed as one fund, another percentage of market value fund, 5% of the market value for the 5 years preceding the last previous fiscal year is the dollar amount used to make payments from the fund, which is used to provide an offset to the K-12 formula funding. And for fiscal year 2023, that amount is roughly $32 million. In terms of...
Sorry, we've got a question, Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. So the $32 million that's generated, that just sort of augments the formula funding, the BSA funding. It's just sort of a added funding source in addition to the general funds that we fund education with.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that's correct. On slide 13, we show the investment statistics. It is a long investment horizon fund targeted with about 69% equity and 31% fixed income. The balance as of 12/31 is $850 million. The one-year rolling return as of the end of December was 12.56%. And the 10-year return is projected to be 5.62%, and that's a long-term projected return. And before I get on to the next slide, I just wanted to mention, I believe last year we talked about the introduction of a state investment review board that was started by the Commissioner of Revenue, and it is now up to, we're about to have our sixth meeting to go over the investments that are under the fiduciary care of the Commissioner of Revenue. And so we've had these meetings. We have the IAC, the Investment Advisory Council, for the pension funds also providing guidance separately to the state funds under this committee. And so we have documentation of the discussions that are at the meeting. We talk about the asset allocations, and all of the information is available with the agenda and minutes on our website. Moving to slide 14, the other group of investments that the Treasury manages are for the retirement and health systems. And on this slide, we show the historical assets for both the public employees retirement system and the teachers retirement system, both the pension as well as the healthcare defined benefit plans. And so at the end of 2021, you can see that we have $31.7 billion at June 30th. slide 15 shows the investment allocations, and you can see there is a much more diverse target asset allocation for the retirement funds than many of the state funds. 49% is allocated to equity, public equity, 30% to private equity, and 21% to fixed income. At the end of December, we had assets for the PERS defined benefit and healthcare plan of $22.5 billion and for the teachers, $10.8 billion. And you can see the returns for the year ending at the end of September of 24.64%. Those returns are calculated by our performance consultant, Callan and Associates. Our internal returns are, as of December, closer to about 19%. So we'll move on to our discussion about cash flows, and just to remind you, our cash management section in the Treasury Division manages all of the banking relationships as well as the cash flows in and out of the state, as well as forecasting all of our expected cash positions on a daily basis. And slide 17 is somewhat of my disclaimer that when we're talking about funds or money movement within the Treasury, we're talking about cash balances. We're not talking about the amounts that you will see in the ACFR or the annual financial report or what's in the budget. So it's actually the money that's residing in the bank. And sometimes people ask us questions about balances, and we try to remember to say this is the cash balance when we respond to questions, because there may be some encumbrances or money that's due some of the funds, and we want to make sure that we make that distinction. On slide 18 is just a graphic of money coming in and out of the general fund proper into the Division of Treasury. You can see that we get tax revenues, and we also get the federal dollars, say, for Medicaid or grants on their way into the various funds. But it all comes in through the general fund and then goes to the smaller funds maybe that are going to use the monies that come in.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Benjamin.
I remember in 2020 when the CARES Act money came in, there was essentially a big deposit in the state treasury, wasn't there? The initial payment from the federal government.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, yes.
And will that follow up be, is that expected then with the federal infrastructure money? Or do you have any plans or any sort of sense of how that would come into the state treasury?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I think I'd like to confer with the infrastructure lead, Miles Baker, and we can get back as to the exact timing of when we anticipate the various funding streams from those bills.
Mr. Co-Chair, I would be very interested in that response and to know if we have some sense of timing and also amount, which we may or may not have. I have another question, but I'll save that for later on, going back to the first CHERS fund.
Slide 19 is a discussion of cash flow deficiencies. I think it's an interesting point to note that historically, many of the funds that came into the state came into the general fund and stayed there for operating or working capital account purposes, and the monies were put into the budget to spend money from the general fund for different purposes. However, over time, there were many sub-funds that were created to segregate money for specific purposes, and that's resulted in less cash available to pay for day-to-day operating costs. So the general fund proper has generally been smaller than in the past. And we get cash flow deficiencies because of that, because money may come into the fund after we need to make payments for our expenses. And a great example of that are some federal program mismatches, because we need to spend money before we can call the money back. So we'll spend out money and then we'll get reimbursed for, say, like Medicare or transportation costs.
Is there any sub-funds associated with the statutory budget reserve?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the statutory budget reserve is part of the sub-funds within the Jafonzi.
And the statutory budget reserve fund is not considered sweepable, right, based on the court's action last August? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, that's correct.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, these cash flow deficiencies, that's exactly what you use the CBR for, right? That's why you need a balance in the CBR. So when you're sort of short on cash, you use it and then gets repaid when revenues come in, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wolf, we will talk a little bit more about that, but the CBR is definitely one of the sources in addition to the ERA now for filling the gaps. So the department has a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Administration, OMB, as well as law, that we developed to kind of give us a playbook for how we deal with cash deficiencies. And it walks through for us the process we would take of dealing with those deficiencies. The cash flow balance that we target has like a floor of $400 million. That is a number we've developed over time that is really coverage for 2 days of high volume outflows. So in a perfect storm, we would need about $400 million to cover a couple of days of our expenses if everything was called at once. The MOU talks to temporary interfund borrowing, and that is really where we have the transfers from the statutory budget reserve, the constitutional budget reserve, and now the earnings reserve account from the permanent fund corporation or subfunds from the general fund. And those are definitely targeted towards temporary short-term cash flow mismatches that we expect revenue to come in to pay and make whatever source we receive the money from whole again. There have been discussions about our structural deficits in the past, and this is what we call a true revenue shortfall. But if we see that we have a revenue shortfall coming and we don't have a backstop in the budget bills, we would need to take measures to address that. And our first order of business would be to seek legislative action to access additional funds, either through an appropriation, a supplemental, or other cash reserves, as discussed above. Finally, in the end, if we can't get additional funds, we might have to limit our disbursements.
Representative Edgman.
So this discussion here kind of brings me back to this table and the conversation we had. I can't remember if it was May or June or July or whatever it was, but we were talking about possible government shutdown and the administration's ability to move money around outside the legislature's necessary appropriation authority. But speaking of a possible situation that were that to come before us again, you have the ability to move money around, and then also, I think, to tap into the CBR, right? I'm kind of returning to the earlier conversation about the CBR as a cash management tool, but using this process right here with the CBR in the event that you don't have an appropriation from the legislature at hand.
Do you want to address
Sure. Representative Edgman, through the chair. I think the situation that you're referring to for a variety of previous government shutdown scenarios really speaks to the fact that we can only access the CBR for that cash flow inter-year sort of cash flow lumpiness without the three-quarter vote to fill the gap. In the absence of a three-quarter vote, we really would not be able to fill a systemic gap. We'd have to be able to have some sort of certainty that the revenues would eventually come in within that fiscal year to use the CBR as a cash management tool. And so without that language, we would not be able to use it as a tool to fill sort of a more systemic or more ongoing true deficit.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Senator Benjamin?
If, in comparison to last year, the effective date for the annual operating budget, that portion of the bill failed to get the two-thirds vote that it requires, you would still have some tools at your disposal to move money around. And as you said, Deputy Commissioner Fechter, knowing or expecting that, and again, this is under the scenario that this year that the effective date vote fails on the budget, you would have some authority to move money around to make up, to meet expenses in the meanwhile, knowing that the operating budget, once it got past that period of time and the effective date actually came into law, I think it's 90 days, you would have the ability to cover expenses in the meanwhile, to some degree.
Representative Edgman, through the chair, yes, with any number of caveats that we do have borders around what we can do for interfund borrowing. One such example would be that we can't borrow more than we can anticipate coming in. So if we had an issue with, let's say, the tobacco fund and funding appropriations that that fund supported, we could use that interfund borrowing, but we couldn't use it to a greater degree than we would anticipate receipts coming in. So we have a number of borders, but we do have some authority to move pieces around to make sure we can continue to operate government.
So, Mr. Butcher, my final point, quick commentary would be that we do have the ability, should the effective date clause of the operating budget not be passed, we have some tools at our disposal, and maybe that might bear further examination by the committee just as a contingency matter, because we don't know whether we can get the two-thirds majority or not. Last year, there was a period of time where we felt like we might not be able to get it. And I just wanted to probe that a little bit with, we don't get the Treasury Division Director here regularly, and it's just an opportunity to ask you that question.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Representative Edgman brought up the idea of not passing the effective date, but that's not really a cash deficiency. That's more of a legislative roadblock. In other words, that's not a shortage of revenue problem. So if that were to happen, what he was saying, if we waited X number of days, the bill would just become law anyways. It's not an anticipation of revenue. You'd actually have the revenue. It's sort of the anticipation of the bill being passed, so giving the authority to spend the money. That's a different problem than cash deficiency, right?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that is a bit of a different problem, and I know there have been competing legal opinions on that matter over the years as well.
Oh, okay, thanks. So, shifting gears, if you did have a cash shortage, temporary cash shortage for revenue or what have you, I see that interfund borrowing transfer from SBR, CBR, ERA, is that written in a descending order of preference, or is that just arbitrary? Because we hear in this committee that the CBR is sort of the slush fund. You need cash, take it out of the CBR, it comes back in up to a certain amount. ERA, I wasn't aware of that being used for that purpose. And you mentioned it earlier today that ERA is another fund. Is there a sequence of order? Like, what's, you know, you need $100 million quick. Where do you go? And is there a fund of SBRs still has a few hundred million in it, I think. So is there a preference and ease of access sequence?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, it has changed over the years from year to year, depending upon what we have authority to borrow. And currently with the ERA supporting much of the revenue of the state for the past few years, that is generally the first source we go to now, unless there has been a deficit anticipated. So in 2021, we borrowed money from the CBR first up to the amount that was the anticipated deficit. And then we took money from the ERA after so that the money could sit in the Permanent Fund Corporation and earn more for a longer period of time.
Okay, follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure I understood you. So now that we're using the ERA to fund 70% of government, you're saying now that's the first go-to for necessary funds since it's already funding government. Does that lessen the importance of maintaining a higher CBR balance? I mean, this billion-dollar balance, I thought was cash flow. So does that lower that threshold of need for the CBR?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I don't know that it has an impact on the balance in terms of what you want to keep as a rainy day fund. And we know that there is definitely change that is continuing to occur each year in terms of what the ERA fund will be used for, how much will go to state government is not quite decided. And having a rainy day fund is important, and there are many, many ways to calculate what that amount should be. And currently, the view is that $1 billion is about where it needs to be.
Oh, thank you. Just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rainy day fund, and that's certainly appropriate and apt concern. And I remember when oil went negative, and that would probably affect revenue temporarily. And who knows? I guess that would qualify as a need for a rainy day, potentially a need for a rainy day fund and other such circumstances. Thank you.
So the use of the budget reserve funds has been the solution, as I was just saying, for many years for both the cash flow mismatches and for revenue shortfalls. And this has really shifted a little bit more to the earnings reserve account. The CBRF, just a little history about the balance itself, was fully repaid by 2010. And then borrowing recommenced in, I think it was not fiscal year 14, but fiscal year 15. And as of the annual financial report, as of fiscal year 20, that amount that was owed to the CBRF is $12.8 billion.
But Mr. Kochner, if I remember correctly, there's no requirement for a payment plan or no date involved in terms of paying that back. That's just a big IOU out there with really no specificity attached to it. Is that
through the chair? That's correct, Representative Edgman.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if that $12.8 billion was paid back miraculously, it wouldn't really change any functionality of anything, right? We could just say, wow, we paid it back. There'd still be $12.8 billion sitting there that we could use for the next rainy day or as need be, but there's no, it wouldn't, nothing really changes, correct? I mean, we don't.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, you're correct. It's a debt that we owe to ourselves, and you know, indeed, to the extent that we have a situation where there are ongoing deficits every year, that would make the needed balance of the CBR infinity. whereas to the extent that we're able to get a sustainable fiscal plan together that balances the budget without the need for deficit spending, then that $12 billion would indeed probably be far more than we would need for our revenue volatility management.
Thank you.
Representative Edgman?
Yeah, just another interesting example of how we're bound by laws that were passed in a different era. And the CBR, of course, was passed in 1990, I think it was, the CBR language and so forth. But if we were to recapitalize this $12.8 billion, we would at the same time be foregoing the opportunity to put money into like the higher ed fund, which is 5.62% plus a few slides back, or putting money into the earnings reserve, which has made almost 30% last year. So from an investment perspective, some of that is a little out of kilter, right?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I wanted to bring back the concept of the sub fund for the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. So while today we have 100% cash equivalent target as a asset allocation for the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, it has had a much different asset allocation in the past, including monies going in, I think, 2008 to the sub fund, which was targeted at a significantly higher return number. So there are mechanisms to invest the money, but that sub fund can only be used if you don't think you're going to be using the money for about 5 years in statute.
But through the chair, that you're also bound to a certain liquidity threshold at the CBR, right? That means you can't take and invest in more, like the pensions fund, you know, sort of a more diversified portfolio approach. So, in essence, you are bound going forward into having a fund that's basically going to be low earning but very stable because you don't have it in risky ventures.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, that is true for the main fund.
Look, it's through the chair, it's just interesting that our primary savings account seems to be outdated or outmoded or whatever the term is relative to all these other funds that can be a little bit more nimble and earn a little bit more. But I think it also speaks to the era back in 1990, and I was in the building when this was viewed as our fiscal plan, setting up the CBR. Being able to take every last dollar that was out there and sweep it back into this vault, this big concrete vault that the legislature couldn't get to unless they mustered up a three-quarters vote. And but times change and they continue to change, and we now have the permanent fund, and you know, the best decade maybe it'll ever see ever, and we hope that that's not the case. But just a bit of peanut gallery commentary.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems, as I recall, and you can clarify this, there was a court decision made that settlement money was deposited into the CBR, and that helped build up its balance, different than how it was initially structured. And I may be wrong, but for example, let's say there's a I think even if there's an oil tax situation with a corporation and it goes to settlement and they settle and say, well, okay, we'll settle for, you know, $50 million or whatever the number is, that money goes into the CBR. And that was sort of a court case that changed the funding mechanism, and that in part helped the CBR get so big or contributed.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, there is that mechanism, but it is written into the Constitution. It's not a result of a court settlement. So any settlement of mineral leases, bonuses, rents, all those natural resource type revenues will be deposited into the CBR. The court cases that I'm aware of mostly deal with sort of more definitional type matters, what counts as a bonus sale and things of that nature.
Was there an event or events that caused the CBR to grow other than maybe some one-time or, you know, deposits from the legislature. Was there other events that made it grow? I mean, you look at the graph, it's pretty flat for many years, and then it shoots up.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, there have been some pretty sizable settlements that have been deposited into the fund over the years, and in previous years, when we had a much, much higher balance, we had a much more aggressive asset allocation for the subfund. So we did benefit from some good investment earnings over the years until it was drawn down to its current level and pretty much precluded us from having a more aggressive and more long-term asset allocation.
Okay, thank you. And I guess my recollection is that there was a, I thought, an interpretation, a court interpretation as to what defines a settlement or something to that effect that changed. And I can do some research on the side, but I don't know if that rings a bell for you.
So we'll continue on to slide 23 and discuss revenue volatility. So we are now, in fact, at a point where our investment earnings are about 65% of the fiscal year 22 projected unrestricted general fund revenues, and petroleum revenues are 25%. In terms of the petroleum revenues, we have uncertainty every year. Ups and downs, and it certainly is, the number is uncertain in the budget because the prices go up, production changes, volatility abounds in this commodity. With investment returns, we do have certainty for the fiscal year that we're planning for, fiscal year 23, because of the lagging POMV formula that exists for money coming from the earnings reserve account. However, we also have uncertainty after fiscal year 23, so fiscal year 24 and beyond. And certainly volatility has played its part over the years in terms of how much revenue is coming into the state. That being said, there are volatility management techniques that we can take advantage of. Obviously, our access to savings funds and other funds has helped with this situation. And also, what we could do is modernize some of the fiscal tools to include lines of credit in addition to revenue anticipation notes that Deputy Commissioner Fechter mentioned. And there is legislation to add lines of credit. The other techniques that we have, again, managing the timing of earnings reserve account transfers to the general fund. The cash management team manages the cash flows very closely so that we only take money from the earnings reserve account when we need it so that it can stay invested in the fund. We also manage the timing of some of our expenditures like we have done in the past. With the Public Education Fund, which used to be an annual draw at the beginning of July, but has moved to a quarterly and then monthly draw, as they only need to use that fund monthly.
I'd also like to note that we've got Representative LeBond with us. Representative LeBond.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and great timing on my part to come in when you're talking about lines of credit and revenue anticipation notes. So my question about HB 92 and Senate Bill 73, what are the status of those two bills?
Through the chair, Representative LeBond, they have passed the House of Representatives, and it is currently sitting in the Senate Finance Committee.
So I leave this section with a few takeaways on cash flows. And that is, even with balanced budgets, and if all revenue is received, we will still have cash flow mismatches throughout the year. Cash flow forecasting is always wrong, like most forecasting. Revenue shortfalls could occur if you have assumptions that are forecasted improperly. And higher revenue volatility requires greater cash reserves until volatility decreases. The good news, though, is that volatility management techniques are available, and we're using them where and when we can, and hope to have a few more.
Okay. Just would like to also note we've got Representative Carpenter also with us. Do we have any questions, Representative Edgman?
Well, it'd be really interesting to see, and I'm sure you have, you do this internally, but maybe go back to 1977, 78, when oil started first flowing through the pipeline and income tax was repealed in, what, 1982, something like that. But just see the percentage of funding for state government, unrestricted general fund, and then to see that trajectory as it gets to where it is today, where in terms of volatility, we have 65% coming from the permanent fund, 25% from oil, that gets you to 90%, then you got 10% from non-oil. And I think somebody somewhere along the way, including us here in the legislature, deserves a pat on the back for playing a big role in reducing that volatility, although certainly we don't control the markets and the great performance of the permanent fund, but we've also put a lot of money into the permanent fund, as we've seen special appropriations, inflation proofing, and the like, and not taking our 50% as we could have each year and, you know, spending that on capital budget, operating budget, whatever it might be. So I think that's pretty significant that just looking at this, that we've reduced through sound financial management our state's volatility picture. And I don't think that gets enough airplay. It's quite significant. Can I go back to slide 15 for the question?
Sure, question.
I mean, so, and I we went through this pretty quickly, so my memory may be off here, but it says at the bottom, actuarial assumed rate of return, investment return is 7.38%. Is that higher than the permanent fund itself?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the actuarial assumed rate of return is part of the economic assumptions that go into identifying the funding status of the pension plans. And so they use that that number, and it's one of our targets. We have another target based on the asset allocation that we're trying to achieve, and that's roughly, I think it's 6.89%, which is, I believe, different somewhat from the Permanent Fund Corporation. They are at CPI plus 5%, and I think that's, well, I don't want to guess at the number, but it's above 6%, certainly. And so both of the funds have well-diversified plans, the pension funds and the permanent fund, but they also have, you know, different purposes and different liquidity needs and structures. The 7.38% actually was derived in the last experience study that the pension plans and the retirement board is going through currently to determine what it will be for the future, for future actuarial determinations.
And I think to the co-chair that probably illustrates the sort of planning for the unpredictability of the inflows and the outflows, right? Because you've got healthcare costs that can rise unexpectedly, something you can't account for, as well as money coming in from those that are still in tier one and tier two primarily, right? But you still got, I don't remember the number, 30 some odd thousand people overall that participate in this plan, and I'm sure that number's not correct, but it's something like that. But I'm just comparing that to the permanent fund where we've got the PRMV and the 5% payout every year. It's predictable, right? And so there's just, it's a lot more unpredictability built into this, and that's the difference, I'm gonna guess, in your investment strategy.
Any further questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation today. And that will conclude our business for the day. Our next scheduled meeting is tomorrow, February 1st. We'll be hearing a presentation from Christine O'Connor. She's the Executive Director of the Alaska Telecom Association. This is regarding the Governor's Broadband Task Force. It's kind of our entry into starting to look at some of the federal money that's coming in for infrastructure and capital funding. And while we want to focus on the operating budget, you know, this is just such a unique, you know, opportunity with all these funds coming in. We want to start to integrate some of those discussions more into our meeting. So that'll be tomorrow. If there's nothing to come before the committee, we will be adjourned at 2:48 p.m. Thank you.